The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And we are live, except I forgot to do something. Oh, my goodness. The people at NicoleSandler.com who watch on the Listen Live page, I forgot to update the YouTube embed, but we are live, I promise you. And in fact, hold on, I will put the link to the live stream in the chat room there, and maybe during a down moment or so, I can update it. Sorry about that, you guys. So we are live. We are on YouTube, on right? Yes, we started, didn't we? Got to turn that down. I've been ready for hours, so I don't know why. I always get a little discombobulated at the last minute. Maybe it's because, you know, I'm a masochist. Hi, I'm Nicole, and I'm a masochist because I'm working the week between Christmas and New Year's. You know what? I figured I'm home anyway. It's not like I'm traveling anywhere, like to Vail for a ski trip or to my private vacation home near Cabo in Mexico on my private jet, or to Mar-a-Lago, you know, my resort in Palm Beach. That's where the Trump administration is. Trump's at Mar-a-Lago. Pence is skiing in Vail. And Steven Mnuchin took a private jet to his private estate outside of Cabo in Mexico to vacation for the holidays. Yeah, so I'm not going anywhere. So I'm here, so I figured I may as well work. Because if I wasn't working, I'd either be painting or I'd be, you know, like cleaning up and cleaning out stuff, which I need to do, but I don't, any excuse not to do that. I'd rather work. I'm Nicole, and I'm domestically challenged. I really am. I could use a wife to help with the cleaning and stuff. Anyway, my weekend was good. My holiday was good. I did some more painting because that's what I'm doing with my spare time these days. And what else? You know, we were here cooking, hanging. I'm trying to make lemonade out of the lemons we've been handed. This is the first year that I have not been with my daughter over the holidays, or actually for any extended period of time since I adopted her 20 years ago. And so I've been watching all these old home movies and stuff because, look, Allison, you know, it turned 21 in May while we were in quarantine, and it was getting to her. And you know what? Nobody at that age should be stuck in a house with her parents for any amount of time, especially month after month after month. And the problem is because we are old, David and I, and we both have underlying health issues, it's not safe for her to go out to a job and then come home at night. So a few months ago, she did take a new job and she moved out. But since I adopted her 20 years ago, I've never been apart from her for more than like 2 weeks. And that was when she was at summer camp. So it's been a rough ride. And so she actually went to her boyfriend's house for Christmas dinner and stopped by here because she had some mail here to pick up. And so we put on the double layer of masks and the face shield and the gloves. And then we wave from across the driveway and I put down her bag of stuff and then I backed up and she could pick it up. It's horrible. Just horrible. And the year 2020 has been like that. It's like a big bowl of shit with fake whipped cream on top. You know what I mean? It's just been awful. But Lauren in the chat room says, I'm pretty sure you're not as domestically challenged as I am. I ran out of fucks to give once I wiped down the surfaces and vacuum. David does the wiping down of surfaces and occasionally vacuum. I promise you, Lauren, in the YouTube chat room, I am more domestically challenged than you are. And, you know, ask anybody who knows me, who's known me my whole life. Really, if I gave you the tour of my studio, you'd go, oh, okay, I get it. So maybe one day I'll get a little adventurous and go there. Anyway, it is Monday. It is the 28th of December. While most of the world or the country is on vacation, most of the media is on vacation, we're here live. And because there's stuff going on. So not only am I doing my show these 3 days, I'm also filling in for Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen on the broadcast because I am a masochist. Anyway, what's going to happen is mostly I'm doing Brad's show to keep his audience updated on what's happening because so much happened since we last got together. Remember, our last gathering in person was on Christmas Eve Eve. That was last Wednesday, December 23rd, also Festivus, right? So we had our Festivus celebration, and we were waiting to find out what was going on. Well, it was that night that Trump got on board Air Force One and went down to Mar-a-Lago. What? While the NDAA had passed and he vetoed it. And then the Congress passed the COVID relief bill combined with the end of the year omnibus spending bill, which keeps the government up and running through the end of the fiscal year, which is next September. And he hadn't signed that. But Wednesday night, he got on the plane and went down to Mar-a-Lago. And we're all going, what? So let me share with you. I'll give you the brief recap to bring us up to date to where we are now. Okay. So it was late Monday, last Monday, a week ago today, Congress passed this $900 billion pandemic relief package, along with a $1.4 trillion omnibus spending bill to keep us funded through the end of the fiscal year. It sped through Congress in just a few hours, despite the fact that the thing was a whopping almost 5,600 pages long, the longest bill in congressional history, in case you were wondering. And regardless, nobody had time to read it, but it still passed the Senate by a vote of 92-6 and the House by a vote of 359-53. That was last Monday. On Tuesday, Trump released a video. It looked like a hostage video, and apparently it kind of was because he did it surreptitiously, and most of his staff had no idea he was even doing it. In it, he called the bill a disgrace. It's a disgrace, I tell you. Wait, I even have him saying it, don't I? Oh, I didn't. I didn't pull it over here. It's just as well. A disgrace. And he demanded changes. Most notably, that the payment checks be for in the amount of $2,000 per person instead of the $600 that was in the legislation. And he also demanded cuts to all the programs included in this, what he said, in the COVID bill, that weren't in the COVID bill. They were in the omnibus part of the bill. He conflated the two, and obviously he doesn't know the difference. This is a man who, for the last now 8 weeks, has been missing in action. The only thing he's cared about is pushing his propaganda that the election was stolen from him. And you know what that is.
Bullshit.
Right. So okay, so that's Monday and Tuesday. So Tuesday, he's like, sorry, I want $2,000. Nancy Pelosi goes, okay, let's do it by unanimous consent. Well, the Republicans objected to it, wouldn't pass it by unanimous consent. So to bring you, jump ahead for a second, today, right now, actually, the House just spent about an hour debating passing an amendment raising the amount of those checks from $600 to $2,000. Then they changed focus. And now, right now, they are debating overruling Trump's veto of the National Defense Authorization Act. In fact, I can just do this. Hold on. And oh, they're voting. Wow.
Here we go. Does the gentleman from Virginia rise?
Madam Speaker, is the member designated.
This is going on now.
Blumenauer, pursuant to H.R. 965. And for the House, Mr. Blumenauer will vote yes on H.R. 9051.
Oh, they're voting by proxy.
As a member of the Mr. Liu, pursuant to H.R. 965, and for the House, Mr. Liu will vote yes on H.R. 9051.
This is to override the veto.
Ms. Barragán, pursuant to H.R. 965, and for the House, Ms. Barragán will vote yes on H.R. 951. As a member designated by Mr. Lowenthal, pursuant to H.R. 965, and for the House, Mr. Lowenthal will vote yes on H.R. 9051.
Okay.
As a member designated by Mr. Peters, pursuant to H.R. 965, I inform the House Mr. Peters will vote yes on H.R. 9051.
Okay.
Is the member designated by Ms. Moore?
Okay, so this is what's happening right now. They are voting, as we speak, on overriding Donald Trump's veto of the National Defense Authorization Act. They need a two-thirds majority to override the veto. And right before I came on the air, whoever was speaking, one of them was saying, look, I rise to say, let's just do what we did 2 weeks ago when we overwhelmingly passed this bill. Nothing has changed in it. And in fact, the only thing that Trump objected to was something that wasn't in the bill. So there's 7 minutes left on the vote. And most people haven't voted yet. So far, they have 17 yays and 7 nays. So I'll keep an eye on that. But let me keep going. So on Wednesday, the 23rd, that was the last day we spoke. I think it was after the show ended, actually. So he did this. You know, it's your classic news dump when the media is gone for Christmas, right? So on Wednesday, Trump vetoed the National Defense Authorization Act, ostensibly for two reasons. The one that it would require the military to rename bases that were named after Confederate war figures. And the second, for something that's not even in the bill. It doesn't include a repeal of Section 230, which is a law that shields internet companies from liability for what's posted on their websites by them or third parties. And, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Donald Trump is such a moron. Because if Section 230 were not in effect, he would have been booted off of Twitter and Facebook and wherever else he posts a long time ago because these companies wouldn't want to be held liable for his lies that he posts constantly. But I digress. All right. So that happened. And then he left the White House on Air Force One to spend Christmas in Florida at Mar-a-Lago, leaving the nation in limbo. So that leaves us where we were like through the holidays. On Thursday, the finalized COVID-19 relief measure and omnibus spending bill together, known as the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, the CAA, was flown to Florida for Trump's signature, where it sat until last night when he finally signed it. Although we learned yesterday that the staff had set up a ballroom, a private ballroom is how they described it, at Mar-a-Lago for a signing ceremony to happen Thursday night on Christmas Eve that Trump subsequently canceled. But here's the thing, because he didn't sign it before Saturday night at midnight, all these programs expired. Pandemic relief programs lapsed, meaning more than 12 million Americans who rely on them will experience a blip in the aid. Unemployment compensation, federal enhancement payments are shortened by a week. As they're reinstated, there may be a break in payments of several weeks while state agencies reprogram their computers for the new legislation. But the one good thing is at least these bills are retroactive, so people will get the money that they're due. But people are hurting right now and they need the money right now. As for the stimulus checks, this is great. Trump said he only signed the bill last night after Senate leaders committed to $2,000 stimulus checks. Mitch McConnell says he hasn't acknowledged that commitment. Okay. So here's what it boils down to. This impetuous child playing president held his breath till his face turned blue and then relented and signed the bill Sunday night and got absolutely nothing out of it other than a few days of attention and more chaos. He also issued a toothless signing statement saying that Congress will review Section 230, the part dealing with social media companies' liability, and they'll examine voter fraud, and the Senate will vote on $2,000 checks. He's just making this stuff up. Nobody agreed to any of this. And then he said he'd be sending a redlined version of the legislation back to Congress, showing lawmakers which wasteful items he wants removed. Democrats already said they'll just ignore his changes. And that brings us to today. It is December 28th, and right now, the House of Representatives is voting on overriding the veto of the National Defense Authorization Act. And remember, this thing passed by an overwhelming majority. It's interesting. I'm watching the votes here. Let me see if I can't put that shot back up on the screen for you. Well, this, hold on. I gotta change my, this is a motion to suspend the rules and pass. Okay. So, right now, hold on. Let me, I know this is, I feel sorry for the people who are only listening on audio when I talk about the video shot, but, here, let's, we can turn up.
Mr. Bishop,
here we go.
Vote yes.
So people are voting by proxy because a lot of the members did not come back to Congress.
As a member designated by Mr. Carson of Indiana, pursuant to H.Res. 965, I inform the House that Mr. Carson will vote yes.
All right. So this is still going on. I'll keep an eye on it. Just know that the NDAA, again, when it passed a couple of weeks ago, it was an overwhelming vote, veto-proof majority. The question is whether or not any of these Republican members of Congress will have the balls to stand up to Donald Trump. So the House is doing these two votes today. Nancy Pelosi also said when they were debating the amount of the checks to go out, we're going to pass this one way or another. If we don't pass it by whatever universal acclamation or whatever, she said, we'll pass it by majority rules. It will pass today. So that's where we are. And then tomorrow, the Senate is expected to come back and vote on whatever the House passes today. Hopefully, it'll be both of them. Hopefully, they will override Trump's veto, and they will pass the amendment replacing the $600 amount with a $2,000 amount. And keep in mind, $2,000 is still not enough. Now, I'm looking at it. It says they're remaining in the vote 47 seconds. There are still 350 members who have not yet voted, and I'm guessing it's because so many of them are doing it by proxy. We have members standing up and reading off votes for their colleagues who are not there. So, you know, other things, if this happens, if they're successful in overriding this veto, it'll be the very first time that a Trump veto has been overridden by Congress. Again, we'll see what happens. It seems like it's only the Democrats right now who are voting on based on the, you know, by proxy. So all that's going on. In other news, while this is happening, and I'll still keep an, you know, my corner of my eye focused on that, the New York Post today, I just have to show you. Let me see if I can pull this up because I didn't come prepared today. All right. This is this was the New York Post headline. I got to enlarge my shot again. I keep messing with the shot and I keep screwing it up for the next shot. All right. So the New York Post, when it endorsed Donald Trump just a short while ago, their front page said, "Make America Great Again, Again." That was their endorsement of Trump. And the date was October 26th of 2020. Right. And then, whoops. Oh, hold on. and this is the headline today. It reads, "Stop the insanity. You lost the election." It says, "Here's how to save your legacy." And the New York Post has a huge editorial basically telling Donald Trump to shit or get off the pot, saying, "You lost. Time to move on. And if you want to save your legacy, then, you know, stop with the nonsense about the election and the January 6th thing. Focus on January 5th instead in Georgia." you know, I'd be happy if he just doesn't. Yeah. So we shall see. So that's going on. But I love this. Here's a quote. It says, "We understand, Mr. President, that you're angry that you lost, but to continue down this road is ruinous. We offer this as a newspaper that endorsed you, that supported you. If you insist on spending your final days in office threatening to burn it all down, that will be how you are remembered, not as a revolutionary, but as the anarchist holding the match." So now Trump says he's going to head down to Georgia for a rally in support of Loeffler and Perdue on Monday of next week. So there's that. Also happening today, you know, Joe Biden spoke a little while ago. He gave another national address Thankfully, the news channels covered it. And Biden, I'm still looking to vote. They're still voting. Joe Biden opened his, you know, he's talking about the vaccine and everything else that's going on and how horrible the Trump transition team has been in keeping information from them. So he called them out on it. But he started his remarks by saying, hold on, this.
A few brief words about the explosion that took place Friday in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Federal, state, and local law enforcement working around the clock to gain more information on motive and intent. This bombing was a reminder of the destructive power that an individual or a small group can muster and the need for continuing vigilance across the board. I want to thank the police department in Nashville, particularly those five police officers who worked so quickly to evacuate the area before the explosion occurred, risking their own lives. And for all the firefighters and first responders who jumped into action early on that Christmas morning, last Christmas morning.
Right.
Their bravery and cool-headedness likely saved lives and prevented a worse outcome, and we are eternally grateful to that law enforcement agency. And I know the hearts of all Americans are the people of Nashville as they rebuild and recover from this traumatic event.
So Joe Biden started the speech by talking about what happened in Nashville. Horrible. A suicide bomber. That's what it was. Sat in his RV and blew up a few buildings, apparently, in downtown Nashville. You want to know what Donald Trump has said publicly on the subject? Yeah. Crickets. I would have played the sound of tumbleweed, but you wouldn't have heard anything. So, you know, you get the idea. All right. They're still voting. So I'll tell you what. Let's do it. Take a little time out. Let our friends on the Progressive Voices Network get some business taken care of. So we'll do that. See you in a minute. Hopefully that worked. And yes. And while they're doing that, let me tell you who our guest is today. Sasha Abramski is going to join us. He is a freelance journalist and author. He's written a bunch of books. He's been on the show a number of times over the years. He has covered Donald Trump since he announced his run. And he's been writing for The Nation all this time. And his latest piece, just written a couple of days ago, is called... Hold on, as she brings it. Trump is guilty of sedition and must be brought to justice. So we'll talk to Sasha Abramski in just a few minutes. Hopefully, we'll have an answer to this vote, maybe even both votes, by the time the show ends. Still, the voting time is up. There are still 296 members who haven't yet voted, so this is going to go on for a while. So in the meantime, we'll take a quick time out and listen to Lauren Mayer's latest. We love Lauren Mayer around here. And this one, it's an original. It kind of looks back on the year, you know, the year 2020 that we wish would just end already. Just a few more days. All right. Take it away, Lauren.
It's been a year full of crises aplenty. So much to cope with. It hasn't been fun. But now we're nearing the end of 2020, a year we thought would never be done, and during which we had to try to keep our spirits from sinking. So I guess I picked the wrong year to quit drinking. All the troubles into which the pandemic thrust us, toilet paper shortages, homeschooling, economic doom, daily reminders of the need for racial justice, and never knowing who or what might pop up on Zoom. At least a lot more states legalize what we need. So I guess I picked the wrong year to quit smoking weed. Science denial nuts had a lot of us swearing, as with the CDC, Trump tried to intervene. But the same jerks who cried hoax and politicized mask wearing were the first in line to get the vaccine. The White House COVID response was downright flaccid, so I guess I picked the wrong year to quit dropping acid. We finally elected elected competent leaders in Biden and Harris, and we can send that whole corrupt clown car packing. But the margins were close enough to scare us, not to mention all the threats to unleash the Kraken. As our hopes for a blue tsunami kept narrowing, I guess I picked the wrong year to quit shooting heroin. Now it's up to Georgia for control of the Senate. How much more uncertainty can we take? As the pundits tell us time and again, it is nothing, oh, just our entire democracy at stake. But if we can laugh, it'll help us pull through. So I guess I picked the wrong year to quit sniffing glue. Now I'm not advocating substance abuse, just making a joke. Although I picked the wrong year to quit snorting coke. Just kidding. Maybe.
Wait, hold on. We're going to do something. I'm trying. Let's do this.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, I am back, and we're now waiting for our guest. I'm looking up, and Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland is now speaking. Let's hear what he's saying. He's probably voting by proxy for somebody else.
As the member designated by Mr. Huffman, yep. Pursuant to House Resolution 9.
That's why this is going to take a while, because most of the members did not return to Washington for the votes. They are voting by proxy. As of now, the yeas are 119. The nays are 55. There's one Democratic nay.
The gentleman from North Carolina rise.
54 Republican. But there are a bunch of Republican yes votes as well. Again, they're voting right now on overriding the presidential veto of the National Defense Authorization Act. And make no mistake, I'd rather, you know, them not pass this ridiculously bloated bill for it's not defense, it's for war. But this isn't the way to do it. They need to cut the war budget. They need to cut the budget for this, but not the way that Donald Trump is doing it. And the reasons that he's doing it for are
bullshit,
you know, because he doesn't want to rename bases that were named for Confederate heroes or anti-heroes, and because there's nothing in the bill that has nothing to do with the bill about social media companies. It's just astounding. Just astounding. All right, let me tell you one other thing before we move on. I came across a tweet this morning on my Twitter travels from Dr. Phillips, MD, Dr. James P. Phillips, who was an emergency room physician at Walter Reed Medical Center. And he was on duty when Donald Trump was brought in after being diagnosed with COVID-19. And after Trump insisted on being driven around to wave at the people while he's infected with COVID, Dr. Phillips tweeted something criticizing him. Let me read to you from a news account of what happened when that happened. Dr. James Phillips, the emergency room physician who publicly criticized Trump's decision to drive with Secret Service agents, to greet supporters while he was hospitalized with COVID-19 in October, has been removed from Walter Reed National Military Medical Center schedule starting in January, according to sources familiar with the situation. Phillips is a chief of disaster medicine at George Washington University and worked as an attending physician on a contract basis for Walter Reed, which is located in Bethesda, Maryland. On October 4th, after the president rode in his motorcade around the hospital, Phillips tweeted, quote, "Every single person in the vehicle during that completely unnecessary presidential drive-by just now has to be quarantined for 14 days. They might get sick. They may die for political theater. Commanded by Trump to put their lives at risk for theater, this is insanity." That tweet has since been removed. But this morning, or yesterday, I'm sorry, I saw it this morning. Yesterday, at Dr. Phillips MD tweeted, "Today I worked my final shift at Walter Reed ER. I will miss the patients and my military and civilian coworkers. They have been overwhelmingly supportive. I'm honored to have worked there, and I look forward to new opportunities. I stand by my words, and I regret nothing." Good for him. And how heinous is it that this man, this doctor, who's so needed right now, was relieved of his duties because he dared to criticize a dear leader for doing something really stupid that put other people's, other health officials and Secret Service members and others at risk? This is America. 23 days. We got 23 days left. All right. I'm going to bring in our guest now. I told you Sasha Abramski is going to join us. Sasha is somebody I've been fortunate enough to talk with a number of times over the years. I think the first time I spoke to him was regarding a book he wrote about the American way of poverty. And that has stayed with me. And I've actually done a number of interviews on that subject with other people. Sasha, I don't know if you've seen Nick Kristof and his wife, whose name escapes me at the moment, did not only a book, but a companion documentary dealing with poverty in America that was quite brilliant. And I thought of you the whole time I was talking to Nick about it. You two should get together and compare notes because you both do amazing work. Do I have you? Talk to me.
You.
Oh, there you are. I'm good. How are you doing? Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, too.
And thank you so much for joining us in the middle of this holiday week. It's crazy time. I mean, I remember the days of when there were something called like slow news days, and it was usually like this time of year, right, around the holidays.
It was a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there was such a thing as a slow news day when, people, everything would shut down and they'd be searching for, you know, for little sidebar stories to run during the holidays, happy little heartwarming features and things. And that just doesn't exist anymore. So, Sasha, you have been covering, you're a freelance journalist. You're an author of a number of books, and not only the American Way of Poverty, but your most recent one, Little Wonder, the fabulous story of Lottie Dad, the world's first female sports superstar. I'm going to have to ask you about that one of these days. But you've also been covering Donald Trump since he started running for president. Yes. I mean, what a beat to cover.
I got to say, I am so looking forward to not having to write a twice weekly column about the depravities of this administration.
Oh, my goodness. I'll bet. I yeah. So you have been, and I went back through the archives at The Nation. That's a wonderful thing about websites like that and publications like The Nation that have been around for so long that you can go through. And I see articles, I see your byline going back to 2004. But the first mention of Trump that I see in your articles at The Nation are from February of 2016. He did that infamous escalator ride in like June or July of 2015. Was it like February when you finally realized that maybe this is like not a joke, that he's serious about this?
No, I knew from the get-go it wasn't a joke. And if my memory serves, I had a conversation with my editors at The Nation probably in October or November of 2015. And I actually remember very clearly the first assignment. The first assignment was examine the man's language, because I'd been talking to the editors and I'd say, look, you have to understand Donald Trump as a demagogue, not a politician. And you've got to understand Trump as someone willing to use. I mean, I thought from the get-go he was willing to use fascist rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And back in 2015-16, that was a little bit controversial because I was basically saying, look, you can't analyze the Trump candidacy and you can't analyze the Trump era through a normal political lens. You have to step outside your comfort zone and sort of understand him as something not just a little bit coarser and cruder than the norm, but just qualitatively different. And so I started analyzing the language he was using and the way he communicated and the way he would build a crowd and an audience. And that really was what got me started. So, no, I knew from the get-go there was no laughing matter about Donald Trump, that he ought to be taken deadly seriously because he had a potential to become the president. It was very clear to me there was a sort of demagogic opening there for him.
That's frightening. So, was there one moment that you it all came to reality hit? For me, it was when he won, because I guess I believed the polling. I really thought that there was no way in hell that the Republican Party is going to let this guy win. I thought there's no way they're going to let him get the nomination. I mean, they'll go through the motions, but they're not going to let him have the nomination. And then he got the nomination. I thought, there's no way in hell he'll win. And I still remember that night exactly where I was watching the TV when they declared it, and the pit in my stomach and the feeling that overtook me. And I that's when I thought, we're living in an opposite world. We live in a different universe. When did something ever come over you and go, oh my God, this is going to be really bad?
Well, I knew from February 2016, and I'll tell you how I know the sort of exact moment. I wrote a political obituary of Donald Trump after the Electoral College was declared for Biden a few days after the election. And so I went back and I looked over all my old articles. And I remember the first reported piece I did on Trump was early 2016 in the Nevada caucus. And it was just after Trump had run a series of adverts on television saying that there would be a total Muslim travel ban into America under Trump.
Oh, yeah.
So I went out to Sparks, Nevada. I drove out from Sacramento. And I thought, well, you know, I kind of think I know what caucus voters think economically. I know they don't like Obama's tax policy. I know they don't like big government spending and so on and so forth. But that's going to be the same for any and all Republicans. What I don't know about, but I have my suspicions, is what they think about immigration and about Islam in particular, the Muslim religion. And so I started asking Trump caucus goers in Sparks, or the church in Sparks, what do you think about Muslims in America? And one after another, they gave me two answers. One answer was deportation, and the other answer was execution.
Oh, my God.
Public. They weren't like saying, we'll come to the side and I'll tell you. They were quite unabashed about it. They were saying in public a genocidal vision about immigration, and in particular about Muslim immigrants. And I remember I went back to the car and I was shaking. I'd been there for a few hours at this point. I was absolutely shaking. And I phoned a journalist friend of mine in D.C. and I said, I think we're in for a nightmare that we've never experienced before. And my friend said, it's not going to happen. America's not like this, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I don't know. I actually think that Trump is tapping into certain trends that have been growing for decades, and that he's realized there's a sort of very authoritarian nativist strand in American politics that is looking for a strongman leader and looking for a leader who is willing to embrace violence. And I think from that moment in, I felt like I was, you know, on top of a roof, screaming from the rooftop, saying, pay attention, something really, really bad's unfolding. And I couldn't quite work out how to convey that message. And I think, you know, I'd go to friends' houses and I'd say, look, you know, this isn't normal. Something quite extraordinary is unfolding. And they sort of look at me like I was a little bit, you know, out there, and maybe had lost my sense of grounding a bit. And I guess I spent the last 4 years, not with any sense of satisfaction, but I think I've spent the last 4 years sort of saying, you know what? We should have paid more attention early on, because the writing was on the wall about Donald Trump and about, you know, what was being unleashed in the body politic. Mm-hmm. I guess I, you know, long answer, but by November of the election period, even though the polls said Clinton was going to win, it didn't surprise me that Trump pulled out a victory. It seemed to me he had sort of worked out a very narrow path to an electoral college win that had nothing to do with the will of the people, nothing to do with majoritarian, but it was effective and it was dangerous.
It was. And I, maybe I'm totally wrong here. I think it was purely by luck. I don't think they had some deep strategy to target certain districts in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio, thinking that they're going to win those and eke out a victory, of electoral college votes by winning like something like 70,000 votes, losing the popular vote and by their winning the election.
No, I think undeniably, you know, when historians look back on this, there was an element of luck and there was an element of chance. You know, Trump was lucky in so many different areas. He was lucky in the fact that for various reasons, Hillary Clinton turned out to be a remarkably weak candidate. You know, he was lucky in the fact that large numbers of Democrats in key states just didn't go out to vote. He was lucky in the fact that the FBI, you know, for whatever reason, published that, you know, extraordinary thing about Hillary Clinton and the emails just before the election. And there was also chicanery. You know, there clearly was interference by Russia. There clearly was a willingness, if not by Trump himself, then by senior campaign officials, to accept Russian dirt and Russian intervention. And it all came together. And,
right.
You know, when you look at hurricanes and floods and everything, there's all that language about a once in 500 year storm.
Right.
Trump was the once in 500 year storm. Unfortunately, in the same way as the once in 500 year hurricanes and floods turn out to actually be once every 2 or 3 years at the moment with climate change, it's entirely possible that Trump is not a once in 500 year phenomenon, but that our politics is so broken and so corroded at the moment that there is room for other demagogues to start surfacing in the coming years. And that's the challenge. You know, Trump's gone. I mean, he can kick and scream and he can, you know, talk about martial law and everything else. At the end of the day, as president, Trump doesn't exist after January 20th. If he wants to try to be a dictator, he can try, but he's not going to succeed. The danger is that Trumpism as a phenomenon and that demagoguery as a phenomenon is now so embedded in politics, it's going to take years to disentangle that.
Right. And it's so I want to get to the subject of sedition, and we will, but I'm fascinated by this. Do you think that it's the popularity of this Trumpian character that has just grown with the online madness, the QAnon faction, all that whole thing? Or has it always been there, just we hadn't seen it out front?
Yes and yes. It's gotten worse because of the internet. It's gotten worse because of social media. The ways in which we understand information and basically broadcast information and transmit it has changed dramatically, not just in the last 20 or 30 years, but in the last 5 years. And that played to Trump's strengths. You know, Trump is not a sophisticated thinker. He doesn't write wonderful political treatises. He writes tweets. He expresses the nation's id. I mean, that's basically what it is. He says outrageous things, and he says them in a concise, easy-to-understand way, and a significant percentage of the population gels with that. So in that sense, he's a phenomenon of, you know, Facebook and Twitter and everything else. In a deeper sense, you know, if you go back 60, 70 years, you have people like Richard Hofstadter, the sociologist Hofstadter, who wrote about the paranoid style of American politics. Conspiracy thinkers, and wrote about groups like the John Birch Society, which believed in a sort of international global communist conspiracy to undermine the American way of life. You know, there was all the stuff in the 60s about fluoridization of water and the conspiracy that it was designed to, you know, undermine the American, you know, corpus, the body. You know, and that's very similar to anti-vaccination politics today. So there is a strand of paranoid politics in America, and there's a strand of conspiracy-based politics. And that's been true, you know, right from the get-go. For various reasons, conspiracies play well in the American political debate. Usually, though, they're on the margins. So usually they may have 10 or 15 or 20 or maybe even 25% of the population buying in. What they don't have is the imprimatur of a political party, and most particularly the imprimatur of the president of the United States and his administration. What you see in Trumpism is basically an eating of the institutions of state. It's cannibalism. It's basically a series of completely deranged sociopathic individuals who've got into position of extreme power and are using it to break down the institutions of the state. And that's really dangerous. You know, it means even when Trump goes, even when people like Stephen Miller vanish from the scene, or Stephen Bannon, you know, all these other horrific characters, or Rudy Giuliani, their legacy remains. And it remains in a language of violence. It remains in a willingness to embrace any and every convenient conspiracy theory. And that's a political cancer. And, you know, cancers don't magically vanish on their own. If you want to get rid of a cancer, you need pretty aggressive treatment.
Yeah.
you know, America's body politic needs some pretty aggressive intervention at this point.
Big time. And again, there's that old analogy of once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get it back in. And I agree. The internet has allowed this ugliness to fester and grow. And these, you know, the QAnon stuff, I honestly didn't pay attention to it for the longest time because I thought it's just fringe insanity. But it's now widespread. Widespread insanity. It's not fringe anymore, but it's the American right, and the Republican Party seems to be embracing it. They even have two of their believers entering Congress in a couple of days.
When you talk about believing, that's what it is. It's a cult at this point. And so, you know, like any cult, it allows irrationalism to flourish. So when you look at QAnon's theories, basically there isn't any sense of cause and effect anymore that makes scientific sense or evidence. A sense. So if the world doesn't go according to their, you know, scenario, all they do is they change the scenario and they say, well, actually, there's a secret coded message meaning this. You know, Trump says this. Well, he doesn't really mean this. It's in code. What he really means is that. This is bonkers. I mean, this is the stuff, you know, this is the stuff of bedlam. It's the stuff of lunatics in charge of, unfortunately, not an asylum, but lunatics in charge of, you know, a nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, or, you know, 10 years ago, we thought the teabaggers were about as crazy as they get. They were harmless. They were just wearing their tri-cornered hats with teabags hanging from them. You know, they were screaming about taxes. Okay, this is a whole other level. And you got Donald Trump embracing it.
It is. And, you know, when I was very, we may have talked about this before in an earlier show, but back in 1996, when I was starting out in journalism, the first political convention I went to as a young journalist was the Republican Party convention in San Diego. And I flew out to San Diego from New York. I stayed in the youth hostel. I remember it was a lot of fun. But there was a side convention going on at the same time that I also attended. And it was a convention by a very extremist conspiracy-based party called the U.S. Taxpayers Party.
Okay.
And run by a political operative called Howard Phillips, who had come out of the Nixon era Republican Party and then sort of moved to the right. And he embraced every conspiracy under the sun. You know, he believed the United Nations was a one world government. He believed the US government was sending in Black Hawk helicopters into the interior of the country. He believed, you know, there was mind control. He believed the paper currency was a conspiracy. You know, all these wacky ideas. And I went to the U.S. Taxpayers Party convention to see what an extremist irrationalist movement looked like. And it was kind of entertaining. And, you know, the speeches were so crazy that they made for good copy. And I wrote about it for a British newspaper. And then I watched over the next 15, 20 years as those ideas morphed into mainstream Republican ideas. And so by the time you got to Sarah Palin in 2008, a sizable part of the Republican Party was saying and thinking the same things the U.S. Taxpayers Party had thought a decade earlier. And if you then fast forward another 10 years or 8 years from 2008 to 2016, suddenly you have this situation where the Republican Party is actually taken over by a conspiracist. And so if you look at what the last 4 years have brought, basically Donald Trump has mainstreamed not just violent language, but he's mainstreamed conspiracy thinking about how the world functions. And so you've had this ongoing assault on the truth. You know, we don't like something that's said by the New York Times. Well, that's just the mainstream fake news, enemy of the people media, et cetera, et cetera. And so now you have this really crazy situation where after an election in which Joe Biden won by 7 million votes, a majority of Republican voters believe that Donald Trump actually won the election. This isn't reality-based politics. You know, this is sort of X-Files kind of politics.
Yeah.
It's conspiracist, and it's dangerous. It's not entertaining. It's just really, really dangerous to the ongoing possibility of democracy. Because if you don't have a common sense of fact, you don't have a common sense of politics.
Exactly. And now he's, you know, he's still tweeting. But one of the most egregious things that I've seen lately is him tweeting something about he's going to go to Georgia next Monday now to rally for Loeffler and Perdue. But come to D.C. on January 6th. The day that Congress will certify the Electoral College votes, because we're going to be out there. It's going to be wild. Well, these people are taking that word wild as whatever they want it to mean, right? This is where the sedition comes in, is it not?
journalist. Look, I mean, the word sedition, I wrote an article last week, which I know you read, about how Trump is now sort of in charge of a seditionist movement. The word sedition has been used over the centuries in America against progressives. It's been used by in power against people out of power looking to better the lot of trade unions or African Americans or gay Americans, you name it. It's been used to attack people who've pushed for the rights of the vulnerable. Trump's doing something different. And I think Trump actually qualifies as a seditionist, unlike Martin Luther King or unlike, you know, a trade union leader who clearly isn't out to destroy the American governing system. Trump actually is, because what he's doing is he's saying, I don't like an election result that I lost. I don't like the fact that on January 6th, Congress is going to do its legal duty and its constitutional duty and certify that result. And so I'm inviting a whole bunch of violent street fighting thugs, some of whom adhere to a fascist ideology and others of whom just like a good fight. I'm inviting them to DC to quote unquote be wild. Yeah. This is insanity. There's never been a moment in American history where the American president has incited a mob to act violently against American institutions of governance. And, you know, so this is the question. What will happen on January 6th if Congress is debating the Electoral College result? You've got a handful of Trumpites in Congress trying to overturn that result. And outside Congress, you've got thousands and thousands of armed supporters of the president trying to bang down the doorways of Congress and the Senate. And that's a real possibility. You know, you could have the Proud Boys out there, the Oath Keepers, the Promise Keepers, all these groups that are, you know, essentially paramilitary, who now believe that Trump is giving them permission to run rampant in the streets of DC. That's dangerous. It's dangerous. And every single person of conscience in this country, Democrat or Republican alike, should be calling Trump out on this. It's really, really dangerous stuff he's playing.
Without a doubt. But then you have other entities who should know better who are perpetrating this dangerous myth. Rasmussen, which is a polling company, again, they're very right-leaning, and I don't know that they've got the respect of anyone on the left, but they've been around for a long time. They did a whole Twitter thread today. Let me share some of it with you. Rasmussen poll on Twitter writes, come January 6th, those who cast the votes decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. Stalin. They're quoting Stalin. Then they write, come January 6, 2021, Vice President Mike Pence will be presented with the sealed certificates containing the ballots of the presidential election. At that moment, the presidency will be in his hands, and there is nothing stopping Pence, under the authority vested in him as president of the Senate, from declining to open and count the certificates from the six disputed states. If they are, as more than 70% of Republicans believe, certificates from non-electors appointed via voter fraud, why should he open and count them? If the votes of all seven contested states are registered as zero, President Trump will have 232 votes. Joe Biden will have 222. Per the 12th Amendment, the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president. No, that's
bullshit.
That's just nonsense. This is not. So there's this disinformation campaign being pushed by entities that should have some modicum of believability behind them. But this is the bullshit that we're being fed. It's no wonder that 70% of Republicans believe this nonsense.
It's not going to happen. I mean, there's also a lawsuit that a few Republican congressmen have filed today, basically against Pence, but saying that Pence has the right to choose his own electors. This isn't going to happen. It would be the end of American democracy. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen for the simple, you know, not because the Republicans have suddenly renewed their faith in democracy, but because Mitch McConnell knows just how destructive it would be of everything. It wouldn't just be a sort of technical thing where we forget about it a week or two later. It would destroy the country. And the Republicans, at the end of the day, they want power, they want business as usual, they want stability for the economic elites and so on and so forth. None of that happens if you literally bring down the entire constitutional edifice upon yourself. It's not going to happen. Trump is not going to manage a coup d'etat, and Mike Pence is not going to buy into that coup d'etat. There will be all kinds of shenanigans on January 6th. It will be messy, it will be ugly, but the idea that, you know, Mike literally and unilaterally rip up millions and millions of votes simply because they didn't go the way he and Trump wanted them to go, that is not going to happen. I don't believe it.
What does that do to his masses of mobs that are getting riled up in this nonsense, thinking because they've been told by the president that the election was stolen, that he actually won and they believe him? What are they going to do on January 20th when Joe Biden is inaugurated?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is such a toxic situation, and it's such a historically unprecedented situation, because it undermines the notion of a peaceful transfer of power, and it undermines the notion of confidence in the democracy.
I hear you.
It didn't happen when Al Gore lost to Bush, even though Al Gore won more votes than Bush and, you know, arguably had won the Electoral College. It has never happened in American history. And the idea that the president of the United States could take the country right to the political abyss like this, there's no sense of greater good. It's not that Trump is saying, I've got this wonderful agenda in the second term I want to roll out. This is all about Trump's personal survival. This is Trump behaving as a regime leader instead of an administration leader. He's behaving as if the country belongs to him.
Yeah.
It does not belong to him. I don't belong to him. You don't belong to him.
No.
The country does not belong to Donald Trump. He was our employee. He was fired to be president.
Right.
He's now fired. He is not the president as of January 20th. And he can rant and he can rave about it. But that's the difference between a democracy and a monarchy or a despotism. Trump wants the despotism. He's just unfortunate in that he doesn't happen to live in a despotic country.
Right. Unfortunate for him. Fortunate for us. The question is how vibrant is this democracy? I'm looking at the votes right now. The House of Representatives is still voting on overturning his veto of the National Defense Authorization Act. They need 2/3 of the House members to vote in favor of it. And it's close. And my math, admittedly, is not very good. I don't know how yours is, Sasha. Right now, the vote is 275 yay, 134 nay, 21 still haven't voted. And off the top of my head, I don't know if that's going to clear the 2/3 needed. This, by the way, when it passed, originally passed with huge veto-proof majorities. It just shows how frightened these Republican members of Congress are of Donald Trump going against him for something that has nothing to do with the obscene amounts of money that they've put in this bill, which is why I would vote against it.
Well, I mean, I was going to say there are plenty of good reasons to be suspicious of this legislation. Trump's playing games at this point. He played games with the National Defense Authorization legislation.
Right.
He played games with the COVID relief legislation and government funding. He's playing political games to create as much chaos as he can and as much uncertainty in Congress as he can. And, you know, my sense is he wants as much anxiety in the country as he can right now, that he thinks it serves his political interests or just his personal interests. You know, clearly it's going to be a close vote in Congress as to whether or not they get that overturned.
Wait, hold on 1 second. 60% of what is what?
Of the vote?
Yeah.
In
is
the House,
yeah.
There are 438 members?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are 275 now
that have voted in favor,
of this. Okay, well, my husband says it's over, but we'll see. I mean, he's much better at math than I am. I guess we'll find out. We are, unfortunately, at the end of the hour. I've been racing against the clock watching this. I don't think we're going to get the vote before we hit the top of the hour. Sasha Abramsky, I urge everybody to read your work at The Nation and elsewhere as well. They can find you at theabramskyreport.com, but you need to check it because I emailed you. There's a funky thing going on.
My guy is working on it. It's got a technical glitch today. So let's just stick with The Nation at the moment.
Okay. TheNation.com and search for Sasha Abramsky and you'll hear his stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to talk with you. I always appreciate your insight. Hopefully we can continue in the new year.
Have a good new year.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And with that, we are done for the hour. I'll keep watching the votes. I'll take us out with the talking heads burning down the House, because that's what Donald Trump wants to do. Burning down the House. But we're not going to let him. I'm in for Brad Friedman on the broadcast tonight, 8 p.m. on the Progressive Voices Network and at bradblog.com. And I'll be back here tomorrow. It's Tuesday. Gotta Laugh will be here. And we'll be here Wednesday as well. And I'll do something special on Thursday and Friday. I don't know what. Still watching. They have not finished. Have they finished? Have they finished voting? Hold on. Oh, hold on. Whoa. Hold on. Wait.
By electronic device.
And I missed the vote. What was it? Oh, my goodness. I don't know what they said happened. Tune into the broadcast and find out. Here we go.
Pass under suspension of the rules by a 2/3 majority that $2,000 stimulus to be added to the stimulus amount that would now go to the Senate, who may or may not choose to debate and take up that proposal. The House now voting on this bill that would override the president's veto of this year's defense authorization bill, that bill setting programs and policy for 2021. Again, this would need 2/3 of the members voting in favor to pass before it heads to the Senate for their consideration. Live coverage of the House tonight. Here.
Okay, so the first part was only on the motion to proceed. Now they're actually voting on the actual overriding of the veto. So I was watching a vote that didn't, well, it mattered, but it didn't really matter. All right. I'm going to sign off now. Got to go to work on Brad's. I doubt I'll have an answer by the time that show goes to air, but we'll have it tomorrow. So we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. This too shall pass. Bye.